generally, I can say that, you know, our country is considered as one of the developing countries, yes. where about the 50% of the population is women. And women's activities are not hidden from anyone, either in household chores or in office jobs. But due to the lack of awareness and knowledge in this field, women's work is not given enough value. You know, I think that in all societies it is the same.
Yes.
And it doesn't depend on revolution before or after. Always, you know, a very small, you know, lack of awareness towards the women's, you know, role causes this kind of, you know, lack of value of the women's work.
Yes.
And especially in productive and economic work. Women's work is ignored, of course. With further studies and reflection, we will find that women alongside men have historically contributed directly in wage work outside the home,
mm-hmm.
or indirectly in non-wage work at home to family income and national income.
Yes, that's yeah. very true. And we see a lot of women that they are the only responsible person in the family. So she's a mother and she has to be a father. She has to do exactly. everything at the very same time. And they're doing that in a very amazing way.
Yeah, so true.
According to what you said, and based on what we see in society, we could claim, and it would not be wrong to say that the role of woman, a Muslim woman, in her family and in her society is no way to be ignored.
Yeah, it is noticing. I really like to add this, that ignoring the work and economic activity of women is removing half of the active population in the economy from the field of work. And mm-hmm. it shows that achieving construction and economic prosperity is not possible without women.
Exactly.
Due to being in the period after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and the end of the imposed war, as well as the country being in the process of construction and economic prosperity, conditions must be provided so that all people, no difference, men, women, can play their critical role in achieving goals. Therefore, one of the most important issues is to give importance to women in order to find their true place in the political, economic, and social activities of society based on Islam, of course,
yes.
and the Quran.
And we give them some insurance for their future.
Yeah, sure.
Because this woman is going to get old
mm-hmm.
one day after all.
Yeah, sure.
So she has to be sure of her future.
Yeah, sure. And Islam in this field can be very helpful and useful. It shows the way to the women.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, that as I told you, you know, when you move under the light of Islam, it gives you some guidance that it is ignorable. We cannot ignore it, non-ignorable,
true.
Yeah. And, yeah, true, what you say is correct.
Time flies so fast and we do not have further more of time. Therefore, I would like to thank you for listening to us. I hope you enjoyed this program. Thank you very much. Take care until another session. May Allah protect you.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammad Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Imam Rida Masjid, leading imam for Imam Rida Center, was Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo. We might say that it was only for American people, although other people who were interested in Sharia School of Thought, including African people, they would go to this Islamic center.
And Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo was trying to extinguish the fire, but he was not unfortunately successful and he was martyred.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So the new series of the program, The Teacher, is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, philosophers, jurists and thinkers all across the nation of Islam, especially the Shiite ones, who dedicated their life into spreading Islam and the Shiite Islam all around the world. For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the outstanding Shiite clerics and preachers of Islam, Abdullah Ad-Dahdo. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you this episode. Give us some details about the early life and the education of Abdullah Ad-Dahdo.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo, born in 1966 in Morocco, and then moving to Belgium when he was a child and growing up in Belgium, going to the schools over there and learning French language. Then as a religious man, he started to get to know about Shia school of thought, and he was really interested to Ahlul Bayt school of thought, and he converted to Shiism. In order to complete his knowledge and studying on Shiism, he moved to Iran, and he went to some schools, and he went back to Belgium, completed his studies in the university in Belgium. Again, he came back to Iran in order to complete his Islamic studies in Jamaatul Mustafa al-Alamiyya.
Oh, really? Was he a student of Jamaat?
Yes.
In Iran. Okay,
and
cool.
And then you might say, when he went back again to Belgium, he, or mainly Brussels, he started his Tablighi life,
yes,
as the leader of the Ahlul Bayt community, which is mainly for the Morocco people, because in Belgium and Brussels we have different communities. We have Iranian communities, Iraqi communities. Each and every of these communities, they've got their Islamic center. But Imam Ridha Masjid, which was being lead, or the leading imam for Imam Ridha Center, was Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo. We might say that it was only for Moroccan people, although other people who were interested in Sharia school of thought, including African people,
yes,
they would go to this Islamic center, and other people from other communities.
So,
but mainly, okay, this community was for the Moroccan people. Yeah.
So there were Islamic centers before Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo goes to Brussels. Okay, over there. But special centers for the Moroccans,
yeah,
the people from the same country he was born in, Brussels, Belgium, and he was leading the Shiite center over there, isn't it?
Yeah, this is actually what I said, Imam Ridha Islamic,
yes,
Center,
yes,
or you may say Islamic, actually Imam Ridha Masjid.
Uh-huh.
Is one of the masjid for the Shia community.
Yes.
And mainly this community was,
that's
for right, the Moroccan people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdawi. Sheikh Zia, now let's get to some of his tablighi or preaching efforts over there. What are they, Sheikh Abdullah Dahdos?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my brother, dear Sheikh Mahdawi, mentioned, he started his tablighi actions and preaching activities after returning back from the second trip that he had in Iran and completed his Islamic studies in Jamaatul Mustafa. When then he came back to Belgium, he started his tablighi activities and preaching activities in Brussels in Masjid al-Imam Ridha alayhi salam. And he was not only giving lectures there. Besides giving lectures and inviting people, he wrote a book that is Al-Hurriya fil Islam wal-Gharb, that means the freedom in Islam and the West. And also he was involved in publishing a magazine that was in French language. The name was Shu'a al-Hikmah and was welcomed by European people, Muslims, in some countries. That the subject of this magazine was some, you know, legislative, or we may say theological issues.
Yes.
So he was a member of the World Assembly of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, and was invited to give lectures in different countries. He had many visits and trips to Iran to participate in different conferences and also in different countries. Another important point that we should mention about Sheikh Abdullah Al-Dahdo is that he welcomed African Muslims and African Shia people that were living in Belgium. You know, sometimes in some centers and masjids we see in different countries that unfortunately, this is not common, but
okay,
sometimes we see this, that some ethnic issues are involved and are, you know, entered into the mosques and masjids. Some people, they do not allow other nationalities,
okay,
to enter their mosques. This is not something, you know, acceptable by Islam.
Yes.
Of course it's few, but we should be aware that we should stand against it and try to erase it completely.
Is it sometimes because of the standards of the living of that Western country? Or the laws, for example?
No. It's rooted in the cultures of people.
Okay.
You know, we as Iranians, maybe we are more comfortable to
have connection with the Iranians.
Yes.
For example, Iranians, Iraqis, Lebanese, Africans have their own communities over
exactly
there.
Exactly, this is the case.
This must not be the case.
Yeah.
The communities must welcome each ethnic group too.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So that's the point that Sheikh Abdullah Al-Dahdo focused on, and tried to invite African people who were living in Belgium and Brussels especially,
okay,
to that mosque, and welcomed there. No difference, they were from Morocco or from different countries, but you know, maybe these people were not welcomed in different centers, and this was not a good point. And this is not only in Europe. In different countries, I have seen this, that some nationalities are more welcoming to their own, you know,
yes,
friends from their own countries,
yes,
not other nationalities.
Okay. Thank you, Sheikh Zainia. So, Sheikh Mahtavi, give us a picture of the Muslim communities and the Islamic communities in Belgium. Because Abdullah Dahto was working over there, he was active over there in preaching Shia Islam. What communities do we have over there? How many? And give us some details about Islamic communities.
Okay, actually, the population of Belgium is 11 million people. From this 11 million people, above 400,000 people are Muslims. And among this 400,000 people, something around 30,000 are Shia. And I've heard from some of the citizens who are living in Brussels, specifically Brussels, they are saying that Brussels is the same as the Qom. They are saying that Brussels is the Qom to Europe.
Really?
Well, because the actually appearance of the city is really looking like a Muslim country or Muslim city, because most of the women are wearing hijab and you see masajid here and there.
Okay.
Among the Shia community, with this population of 30,000 people, mm-hmm, we have four masjid. This is besides Islamic center, because as far as I know, at least Iranian community, they themselves, they right now they have three leading centers. Yes. That these three leading centers are not included under those masajid.
Okay.
So in such small city, for one community, as mean Shia community, to have four masjid, that is something big, specifically in the Europe. So before we get into the actually last scene of the life of Sheikh, yes, Abdullah, I think this is good to talk about the Muslim environment in that city.
Mm-hmm.
The time Sheikh Abdullah Dahdo got martyred actually is the peak time of ISIS.
Okay.
And we see how the activities of ISIS is going to affect other Muslim environment here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter if you are living in the heart of the Europe. Why? Because we have a big community of Muslims. So this big community, among their leaders, they are going to get effect. I mean, those negative effect of the extremism,
yes,
which is being practiced,
right,
by some sort of Muslims.
Okay.
And the result of this is the clashes and conflicts among Muslim denominations.
Oh.
For which we can see something like this happen.
That's,
but
right,
I think our brother will speak about that,
okay,
much better.
About the details of his shahada.
Yeah.
So he was martyred over there. And that's all right. You know, this ISIS look at the life of the Muslims all here and there, I think culminated and led into a kind of a separation, sedition, disagreement among the Muslims. This is how the Wahhabis and, you know, out of law, is better to say, or extremist Muslims look at the religion of Islam. And this is very much different from the peaceful talks and the efforts that people like Abdullah Dahto had in Brussels. Okay, so Sheikh Zainia, he was martyred. How?
Yes, he was the imam of the mosque at Ridha, and he went into the mosque for praying Salatul Maghrib. He was preparing the mosque for Jama'at prayer, and suddenly the glass of the window was broken and somebody threw a fire into the mosque, and the mosque was burned, and Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdo was trying to extinguish the fire,
mm-hmm,
but he was not unfortunately successful, and he was martyred. Of course, there are some narrations that they may say that one of these takfiri people entered the mosque and hit him by a hammer that killed him at the scene, but some others say no, he was martyred by
the
flames.
Killer, the assassinator, was a takfiri one?
Yes, they were three people, takfiri,
okay,
people,
okay,
that they were giving some slogans regarding takfiris,
okay,
when they were burning the mosque.
That's all right.
And there's a documentary also made by an Iranian director Regarding the life of Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu under the title of Qugnus, that
Phoenix.
In English, yeah, we call it Phoenix.
Yes.
And the title is, you know, good for him because Qugnus and
yeah.
Phoenix is bird.
According to Iranian mythology, or
yeah,
the
and also in other, yeah, in other
in
myths.
Fire, yes.
And Phoenix is burned in
okay.
fire.
Yes.
And Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu also was martyred
this
by
way.
Fire. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul and place him beside Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam and Holy Inshallah. Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Okay. His body was taken out to his homeland in Morocco.
Yes, yes.
yes. And he was buried over there.
In Tangier.
In Tangier, that's right. But the case is that the court of Belgium can say imprisoned the assassinator only for 27 years, you know, because of the killing of somebody. But according to their own laws, you know, for 27 years for imprisonment. That's all right. This was the life of Abdullah Dahdo.
And he was martyred in 2012.
12, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. 10 years ago. You know, that's right. During Namaz and the prayer time and Salat time, he was martyred and passed away. May Allah bless his soul. And may Allah protect all the Muballiqs, you know, and Muballiqas who are trying their best in order to preach Shia Islam all across the world through, this is my emphasis, through peaceful coexistence and peace talks and peaceful manners. And this is how the religion of Islam invites the other people into itself. Embracing Islam through first recognition of the sources, recognition of the ulama, through tahqiq and through peaceful talk. There is no force, there is no killing, there is no assassination. And all these extremist groups and extremist, you know, actions that we could see by some groups are under the flag of Islam, but they are not Muslims. Believe me, these people are not Muslims. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziania.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, yeah. for your presence in the program, The Teacher, talking about Sheikh Abdullah Ad-Dahdu. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ Shia and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
In the limelight.
A new report has warned the coronavirus vaccine divide is costing lives and supercharging inequalities worldwide. We're prepared for you an article written by staff writer of Al Jazeera website under the heading Oxfam warns as the poor die, suffer from COVID, rich get richer. A new Oxfam report titled Inequality Kills says the coronavirus pandemic has made the rich much richer, while the income of the rest of the world, nearly 99% of humanity, has declined. According to the report released recently by the international charity group, the wealth of the world's 10 richest men doubled from $700 billion to $1.5 trillion during the outbreak, which has contributed to the death of at least 21,300 people per day globally. The report warns, "We entered 2022 with unprecedented concern, insisting that the current global state of extreme inequality is a form of economic violence against the world's poorest people and poorest nations." Highlighting the COVID-19 vaccine divide as a key precedent, it further underlined, millions of people would still be alive today if they had had a vaccine, but they are dead denied a chance while big pharmaceutical corporations continue to hold monopoly control of these technologies. The report also emphasized structural and systemic policy and political choices are skewed in favor of the richest and the most powerful, resulting in harm to the majority of ordinary people around the world. The report further calculates that 252 men have more wealth than all 1 billion women and girls in Africa and Latin America and the Caribbean combined, while 10 of the world's wealthiest men own more than the least affluent 3.1 billion people. Additionally, as the rich got a whole lot richer during the pandemic, the incomes of 99% of humanity suffered miserably. It also stressed that growing inequality made worse by the pandemic is sure to cause additional tensions, resentments, and further complicate nations' responses to climate change, to economic disparities, and social instabilities. The Oxfam report underlined, these present-day divides are directly linked to historical legacies of racism, including slavery and colonialism. It further notes that since 1995, the world's top 1%ers have captured nearly 20 times more of global wealth than the bottom 50%, insisting that the pandemic has made things much worse. According to the Oxfam report, the wealth of billionaires climbed even more, and a new billionaire was minted every 26 hours since the pandemic began, compared to the last 14 years. The Oxfam report noted the chief executive officers of COVID vaccine developers Moderna and BioNTech made billions in 2020 as a result of the pandemic, adding that at the same time, the vast majority of the population remains worse off after losing income during COVID-19, and 160 million more people fell into poverty worldwide. Meanwhile, Oxfam argues that governments have the power to radically change course and blunt economic violence at its roots by laying the foundation for a more equal world. Oxfam's executive director, Gabriela Booker, emphasized, "It has never been so important to start righting the violent wrongs of this obscene inequality by clawing back elites' power and extreme wealth, including through taxation, getting that money back into the real economy and to save lives." The Oxfam report says a good start is to impose a one-off windfall tax on the COVID-19 gains of the 10 richest men, which would generate $812 billion. It then pointed out these resources could pay to make enough vaccines for the entire world and fill financing gaps in climate measures, universal health, and social protection, and efforts to address gender-based violence in over 80 countries. The report explained, "Even after the tax, the world's 10 richest men would still be billionaires and, as a group, would have increased their wealth by $8 billion from the start of the pandemic." Gabriela Bucher further argued, "If these 10 men were to lose 99.999% of their wealth tomorrow, they would still be richer than 99% of all people on this planet." Oxfam's report is usually released just prior to the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland, but the gathering of the world's richest and most powerful has been postponed again this year due to the coronavirus pandemic. Recently, the World Economic Forum released its Global Risk Report 2022, warning that the lopsided economic recovery from the pandemic, much of which has relied on the rollout of vaccinations, has deepened divisions within and between nations.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam Khomeini and respect of law. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of respect of law in the life of Imam Khomeini. We can see that being a jurist after the revolution, when the people used to ask him about the following the rules and laws of a country or the Islamic Republic, we can see in all those questions, he has said that you should live according to the laws which are set by the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this Islamic Republic and its laws are applied on everyone who lives within this country, this state, this Islamic state. Therefore, respecting law is the first thing, because when we respect law, it means that we respect that country. It means that we respect those people. It means that we respect the struggle which was behind this revolution. Therefore, we can see clearly that in his life, whenever he was asked about the laws and the rulings which are set in a country, or especially in the Islamic Revolution, he always said and he emphasized to respect it and to live according to these laws, and even not to break a red light in the midnight. If it is 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the midnight and there is no one in the street, and if the lights are red, you need to stay behind it. Therefore, these things shows us that respecting law is the first thing, is the first step to become a good Muslim, to have a good Islamic lifestyle. The first step is to respect the law.
Congratulations to all Muslims across the world on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Listen to our special programs on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. We were talking about the topic of respecting law in the life of Imam Khomeini. Now, when we look at the life of Imam Khomeini, we can see that when he was in France, it has been narrated by many companions who were with the Imam. They said one day, one of our friends, he brought a goat and they wanted to slaughter it Islamically. And because in France they couldn't find the halal meat at that time, there were no shops, so they brought a goat and they slaughtered it in the same yard where Imam Khomeini was living in that house. And later, when they have slaughtered it and when they cooked it and when they brought the food in front of Imam Khomeini, Imam asked them, like, where did you bring this meat from? Because here you cannot find a halal meat. There is no shop of halal meat. They said, like, we brought a goat and we slaughtered it in the courtyard of the same house. And then Imam Khomeini refused to eat that meat. He said that because according to the rules and laws of France, you cannot slaughter any animal within your premises
and obviously there are specific rulings about it. Therefore, it is against the law of France. I will not touch this food. And he did not eat from that food. Now, this shows us that this kind of respect to the law shows us that how bound he was to the Islamic teachings, because Islam talks about the respect of people, respect of laws, respect of others. And if we can learn how to respect each other, we can advance in our life, and Allah will have his blessings upon us, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Innal ladhina qalu rabbuna Allah thumma istaqamu.
Allah, Allah.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, Allah, no, Allah, 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 Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Islamic Revolution as role model for Islamic movements. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. In the second episode of this series, you are going to hear on the role of the Islamic Revolution in formation of Islamic movements in the region. Stay tuned, please. The 20th century was the century of wars, which were mainly waged by the countries seeking power and subjugation of poor nations. The First World War broke out in 1914 and lasted for 4 years, killing millions of innocent people and devastating many cities and countries. This war set the ground for colonization of the Islamic countries by Western states, mainly Britain and France. Egypt, with its geostrategic situation in the region, was subjugated as a British colony. It was in the same years that Britain issued Balfour Declaration, which was indeed the prelude for fabrication and implantation of the Zionist regime in the heart of the Islamic nations. Although Iran had no role in the outbreak and spread of the war due to its strategic situation and the incompetence and servility of its shahs, turned into the road for commutation of Russian and British military. Hence, Iran was illegally occupied by the British forces till the end of the war in 1918. 21 years later, the Second World War broke out, which lasted for 6 years and resulted in coming to power of Russia and the United States of America as the two superpowers of the world. Again, the share of the Muslim nations was famine, disease, devastation of all infrastructures, pillage of resources, and colonization. The unwanted presence of foreigners in the Islamic countries urged many groups and establishments to come to existence, which sought to save their nations from various imported isms like Marxism, socialism, liberalism, and so on. Most of these groups and establishments were led by religious figures and reformists. Sayyid Jamaluddin Asadabadi was among these figures. He traveled to different Islamic and European countries and tried to impact people from various walks of life. Therefore, colonialists expelled him from Egypt and dissolved his party. Asadabadi was influenced by Shia ulema in Iran and Iraq. In 1952, Jamal Abdel Nasser annulled the royal government through a military coup and continued his struggles against colonialism. Yet his movement was deviated due to excessive pan-Arabic ideas and socialist proclivity in economy. In 1948, concurrent with the invasion of the global Zionism into Palestine and massacre of the children of the land by invaders, Muslims tried to repel the invasion. However, the servility, vassalage, and passivity of Arab governments left no ability and motive for them to defend the Holy Land. In 1967, Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, and Syria were allied to destroy the fabricated regime called Israel. Yet, they were badly defeated in a matter of just 6 days. This scandalous defeat set the stage for the decline of Abdel Nasser and turned down many Muslims across the world. In the midst of these events, a great clergyman from the Iranian city of Qom started his worldwide revolution to defend the integrity of Islamic values against the entire world of arrogance, Zionism, and colonialism. He was none but Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, who soon became known as Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini had studied in Qom and obtained the degree of Ijtihad, that is, independent perception of Islamic sciences through the Quran and the words of the Prophet and his infallible progeny, in the age of 27. Thus, in addition to education, authoring books, and training students, he was struggling against the domestic tyranny and foreign colonialism. According to the Quran and the words of the prophets and the infallible imams, this great leader believed that selfishness and giving up uprising for God's sake were the main causes of Muslim nations' misery and dominance of the global arrogance and Zionism. He raised progressive doctrine of velayat-e-faqih, meaning rule of the supreme jurisprudent, as the key to victory over enemies of Islam. This jurisprudent should have a very deep knowledge of the Islamic sciences and should be the bravest clergy who is also well aware of the developments of the time. After the 6-year war of Arabs against Israel,
Imam Khomeini issued a fatwa whereby he declared as haram or religiously forbidden any commercial and political relation with Israel and consumption of Israeli goods. He also issued another fatwa in which he clearly permitted spending alms and zakat for Palestinian combatants. The Iranian nation's struggles against the Pahlavi regime yielded fruit in February 12, 1979, under the leadership of Imam Khomeini. This unmatched event of the 20th century was a beacon of light in the hearts of the world Muslims who had lost hope in salvaging from the clutches of tyranny and colonialism. The Islamic Revolution restored the lost identity of Muslims so that they boasted of being Muslim. Lebanese Shia Muslims considered Imam Khomeini as their leader and built up a strong group called Hezbollah, which has turned into the pain in the neck for Israel and is going to exterminate this cancerous tumor for good. The Palestinian Sunni brothers too loved Imam Khomeini and followed his teachings as the way of liberation of Palestine. The Islamic Iran didn't give up supporting the Palestinian oppressed nation even during the tough conditions of the all-out 8-year imposed war in 1980s. The war ended with the defeat of the superpowers, and the invading Saddam couldn't achieve any of his pre-planned goals of invading Iran. Iran turned into a role model for other Islamic nations who seek freedom and justice. While Western hired political analysts keep prophesizing the Islamic Revolution's imminent collapse, this greatest phenomenon of the 20th century continues advancing towards its lofty goals under the leadership of Imam Khomeini's successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Imam Khomeini's progressive and freedom-inducing ideas have transcended borders and have captured hearts and minds, even in Washington and London. The Islamic Revolution's victory under the unique leadership of Imam Khomeini had a number of ideals, including justice and freedom from the yoke of tyrannical regimes and foreign dominance. But these ideals were not restricted to Islamic countries, as for the recent years, we have been witness to Occupy Wall Street movement in the US and Yellow Vest in France, which mainly fights capitalism and seek justice. This is the meaning of explosion of light, as the Islamic Revolution was called by Imam Khomeini. He opened the way of a struggling against all excessive demands of big powers, particularly the US and the illegitimate Zionist regime. The Imam taught us to be steadfast and perseverant in the way of Allah and put our trust in Allah till our last breath and the last drop of our blood. We will never forget Imam Khomeini's heritage and will march in unity with other Muslim nations under the leadership of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Thank you.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In January 2017, a Canadian man fatally shot six worshippers at the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center and seriously injured 19 others. Over the past 5 years, Muslim community members have pushed decision-makers at all levels to denounce Islamophobia and put concrete measures in place to curb incitement and hate-filled violence, including through stricter gun control laws. Also, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who immediately called the killings a terrorist attack on Muslims, has since faced criticism and calls to do more to stem Islamophobia. Those demands grew louder in the aftermath of a string of hate-filled incidents, including an attack that left four members of a Muslim family dead in London, Ontario, last June. Also, in another hate crime incident, Canada's deadliest vehicle ramming attack happened in 2018, when a man plowed his van into a group of pedestrians in Toronto, killing 10 people. On Friday, the federal government announced in a statement that it intends to appoint a special representative to combat Islamophobia in Canada. But how effective would that be? Muslim Canadians are facing a sharp increase in violent hate crimes in public places and in places of work and worship. One example is the murder of Muhammad Aslim Zafis, who was killed outside a Toronto mosque in September 2020. Most recently, black Muslim women have also been disproportionately targeted by Islamophobic street harassment and assaults, particularly in Alberta. A report says in the last 5 years, more Muslims have been killed in targeted hate attacks in Canada than in any other G7 country. Also, over the past decade, police-reported hate crimes against Muslims in Canada have risen from 45 in 2012 to 181 in 2018. Now, on the fifth anniversary of the Quebec mosque shooting and the National Day of Action Against Islamophobia on January 29th, around a dozen Canadian Muslims are speaking out about experiences of Islamophobia in a new report from the charity Islamic Relief Canada. According to the report, many of those who've shared their experiences felt they were to be expected, living as a minority in Canada. The report also found that more women tended to be the targets of Islamophobia. A report by the National Council of Canadian Muslims stated that Muslims living in Canada have been increasingly facing anti-Muslim sentiments since the 9/11 attacks happened 2 decades ago in the US. The advocacy organization said Islamophobia is systemic in Canada and is evolving. The hate increased in the years immediately following the World Trade Center attack and has slowly grown since, with Statistics Canada reporting that anti-Muslim attacks numbered 99 in 2014, up from 36 in 2009. In 2015, hate crimes ballooned to 159, a 60% jump, and in 2017, incidents showed a dramatic increase to 349. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Saturday said that Islamophobia is not acceptable at any cost and vowed to make his country safer for Muslims. But how successful has Trudeau been as a leader to address systemic Islamophobia as a major priority in Canada? Human rights advocates have criticized Trudeau's government for failing to meet its promise to deliver legislation to address hate crimes against minorities.
Now, the point is this, that this actually is not just as a result of 9/11. The level of Islamophobia around the world was actually very high even before 9/11.
Justin Trudeau had said while he is deeply opposed to Bill 21, which bars a range of public servants in roles of authority, including teachers, from wearing visible religious symbols, his government won't step into the legal challenge taking place in Quebec to avoid triggering a fight with the province over jurisdiction. In December 2021, an elementary school teacher in Quebec was told she could no longer teach in class because she wears a hijab, which is prohibited under Bill 21. That marks another failure for Trudeau as he falls short of condemning the bigotry against Muslims wearing symbols of their faith in his home province. Jeddah is the second largest city in Saudi Arabia and is home to 4.5 million people. Since late October, at least a million people in Jeddah have had their lives turned upside down amid a large-scale demolition push by the government. Residents say the demolitions have taken them by surprise and given them little to no room to plan their relocation because it was on short notice. The displacement has caused a housing crisis, with rental prices skyrocketing across the city. In some cases, rents have doubled in a matter of days and many aren't able to afford them. At least 10 neighborhoods have been completely wiped out so far, as work continues in around another 10 areas. The plan targets some 60 districts, mostly located in the city's southern part, and is expected to continue for months. Online footage and satellite images show the wide-scale destruction of entire neighborhoods, which have been turned into dust. In 2020, similar demolitions carried out in the northern Tabuk province made international headlines. Saudi Arabia's Al-Huwaitat tribe sent an urgent communication to the United Nations, calling for an investigation into allegations of forced displacement and abuse by Saudi authorities. Their request came after months of alleged harassment, arrests, and abductions by the Saudi forces, apparently due to the tribe's refusal to relocate to facilitate the government's NEOM megacity project. Also, Saudi security forces killed an Al-Huwaitat tribe member, Abdulrahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al-Huwaiti, who was an activist protesting his eviction. He had also denounced the NEOM project on several occasions. At least 20,000 members of the tribe now face eviction due to the project, with no information about where they will live in the future.
And they've even destroyed most of the religious monuments of people like the prophet, peace upon him, and his household. So this bulldozing history and bulldozing tradition is really in their blood. So I'm not that surprised that they're doing this kind of nuclear scale urban renewal, so-called project in Jeddah.
The Saudi Crown Prince's desert dream, NEOM, is due to completion in 2025 on Tabuk's Red Sea coast. It's a city designed to attract international investors, but has been subject to scrutiny since it was announced in 2017, with critics calling it wasteful and inefficient in addressing the problems of the Saudi economy, including unemployment and dependence on oil. Currently, over 11% of Saudi citizens are unemployed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's oil sector still contributes up to 80% of the country's budget revenues, while 88% of Saudi Arabia's foreign income is from oil exports. Details of the NEOM project prompted a flurry of reactions when it was first announced, as people accused Mohammed bin Salman of using extravagant technology to cover up the kingdom's human rights abuses. Ever since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has ramped up arrests of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others perceived as political opponents, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnations of the crackdown. The destruction of communities on the NEOM side follows decades of tensions between the House of Saud and the tribes it has ruled over since the creation of the Saudi state in 1932. Exerting control over the land through construction projects or destruction of some heritage sites have marked this rule. In 2017, the UN condemned the kingdom's forced demolition of the walled city of Awamiya in the eastern Katif region as violating human rights.
The United States military has come under intense scrutiny over its procedures to guard against civilian casualties after a high-profile mistaken drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan.